The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the theme that I was thinking of reflecting on with you today is Dharma. Dharma. What is Dharma? What is Dharma? The Sanskrit is Dharma. The Pali is Dhamma. And there are at least three different ways this word is used in the texts. And so I thought I'd start by just describing those three ways, and then maybe, you know, go into a little more depth on each of those and how they interconnect, how those three different meanings actually relate, how they come together. So one of the ways the word Dharma is used is just simply to mean experience. The moment-to-moment experience of your life is called Dharma, Dhamma. Just the Dhamma of seeing, of hearing, of smelling, of tasting, of touching. Just experience. So sometimes that word is used just to mean experience. In a very simple way, like, you know, oh, I had the experience, you know. So it's not got a, we can say it's not got a capital D to it. You know, it's the small D Dhamma. It's just experience. Another way this word is used is as truth. So this is kind of Dharma with a capital D. The truth of, I think truth in many ways, in terms of what we're exploring here, I think, and this then comes to the third meaning of Dharma, which is what the Buddha taught. So the teaching, or sometimes the word Dharma or Dhamma means doctrine or teaching. And so we've got those three meanings: the truth, a doctrine, and experience. And so in terms of the doctrine or the teaching that the Buddha offered, sometimes called the Buddha Dhamma, he was interested in exploring the truth of things as they are. How are things? I mean, we can look at what does truth mean? And it's like truth is, we could say truth is a description of how things are, right? I mean, that would be one way to look at what truth is how things are. And, you know, there's so many different things we could think of in that respect, you know, how things are in the universe, you know, the gravitational laws, or weather, you know, what's the truth about weather? So there's kind of the truth perhaps about things in the world, processes at work in the world. And then what the Buddha was most interested in exploring was the truth of our minds, the truth of our experience. So the Dhamma of our Dhamma, the capital D Dhamma of our small D Dhamma. So that's what he was interested in exploring. What is the truth of our experience? And in particular, this question of why we suffer. You know, what is the truth about that was actually one of the Four Noble Truths are framed not using the word Dhamma, but using the word Satcha in Pali. So it's a different word for truth used in the Four Noble Truths. But the Four Noble Truths are framed, you know, in terms of suffering, the cause of suffering, the possibility for the ending of suffering, and the path that will lead us there. So the Buddha at one point talking to his followers, his disciples, went out into the forest, and he said, which is greater, the number of leaves on all the trees in all the forest? Or he picked up a handful of leaves, and he says, or the number of leaves in my hand? And it's like, wow, is this a trick question or something? You know, well, obviously the leaves in your hand are less. The leaves in the forest are greater. And he said, well, what I know, what I understand is vast. It's as much as the leaves in the forest. What I teach is as much as the leaves in my hand. Because what I teach is relevant to the end of suffering. And so he didn't say that his dharma explains everything. He said it explains how we suffer and also how we can come to an end of that suffering. So that's the focus, that's the core of the Buddha Dharma, the teaching, or the teaching of the Buddha. It's not to explain truth of everything, but to explain and explore the truth of our human condition of suffering and how it might be possible for that to come to an end. So the Dharma of the Buddha, I, in reflecting on this, one of the little thoughts that flitted through as I was reflecting on this was that there are like two sides to what the Buddha taught. Two different kinds of teaching, in a way. The first is, I would say, a kind of a description of the truth of suffering. So a description of the processes at work that make suffering happen. So it's a description in a sense of that capital D Dharma, of the truth of suffering. So it, you know, this includes the teachings, for example, of anicca, dukkha, anatta, which Maria will talk about in the coming weeks, the truths of that's one of the key, in fact, definitions of truth in this teaching, is that all experience, and again, this is small d Dhamma, so every experience that we have, there's nothing that is permanent. No experience will last for more than a split second. Because of that impermanent flux to experience, there is also no experience that is reliable as a place to say, that's it, that's what's going to do it for me, that's what's going to make me happy. Because the moment we kind of congeal or solidify, oh, that's it, it's already slipping away, it's already vanishing. We can kind of hold on to it with concept for a while with our minds, but it doesn't last. And so the truth of all experience, of everything that happens to us, is that it is impermanent and it is unreliable in terms of what would make us happy. And the third characteristic, that it is also not me, not mine, not who I am. What happens, this moment-to-moment flux of experience, not me, not mine, not who I am, in terms of how we typically think of ourselves as an entity, as a thing. This kind of impermanent, fluctuating nature of experience is a process rather than an entity. One of the ways of thinking about it is there's no thing anywhere. It's all just a flux and change. And, you know, even this podium, you know, this podium seems pretty solid, right? I mean, here it is. It's going to be here. Probably going to be here tomorrow. Probably going to be here for another 10 years. You know, it's a pretty solid thing. But it is also in a process of change. I mean, at one point, it was a tree standing somewhere in a forest. And that tree also seemed pretty solid. And yet, it gets cut down. And when does it stop becoming a tree? Does it stop becoming a tree when it gets cut down? Does it stop becoming a tree when it gets put on the truck and milled? You know, does it stop becoming a tree when it becomes bored? At what point does it stop becoming what we think of as tree? And for each person, that will probably be a different place. And likewise, even just this thing here, you know, it's wearing away. Every time I sit down on it, every time anybody touches it, a little bit of the particles, and this we know from particle physics, right? A few of the particles of wood come off and they're just moving out into space. So that's kind of talking about things in the world. What the Buddha was more interested in was our experience. And is there, so again, then this is looking at the leaves in the hand. What is it that will lead us to happiness? Isn't perhaps so much understanding about when does something become a tree or when does something stop becoming a tree. But looking in our experience, the way we identify with things, the way we cling to things, the way we take things to be things, is a large part of the delusion at work in our minds that creates suffering. So the way that our mind, you know, decides or creates things often is related to our own wishes, opinions, ideas, views of like who we are, what we want, what we like. So, you know, we create identities of ourselves. We have opinions about who other people are. We create this separation of us and them, of me and other. And the understanding of this fluctuating nature of experience is that there is no kind of one place or one time where we can like stop the flow and say, this is it. It's going to be different in the next split second, in the next split second, in the next split second, in the next split second. So the Buddha points to actually these three truths of impermanence, unreliability, and not self, which are truths of our experience. And radically, I think that is really what the Buddha was mostly talking about. He talked about cultivating the perception of impermanence, cultivating the perception of unreliability. So cultivating it as the understanding in our experience. He didn't so much talk about it in terms of a reality that, I don't think he would have talked so much about this thing here is impermanent. He would have talked about our perception or our experience of things is impermanent, unreliable, because he was interested in suffering. He wasn't so interested in describing the metaphysical universe. That's my understanding. He wasn't so interested in describing the metaphysical universe. He was more interested in understanding the processes at work in our minds and how suffering is created. So this is one of the descriptions of truth, of Dharma, in the Buddhist teaching. This unreliable, impermanent, not-self nature to our experience, our small d Dhamma, the little d Dhamma. One way to talk about this. Another kind of avenue into this core teaching or, you know, way the Buddha talks about suffering is that our suffering happens because we're not seeing things as they are. If we're interested in entering into the truth of how things are, we've got our apparatus of our minds and our bodies that take things in, and we think we know what's happening. You know, we think we are seeing things as they are. And yet one of the key things the Buddha points to and discovered is that we don't. We don't see things as they are. We have such a veil of delusion, a veil of filters of ideas, opinions, views that we see things through, that we are not seeing the truth. We are seeing things through our ideas about truth, our ideas, our concepts. So we have all of these ideas, these filters at play in our minds. And we mistake, I think one of the key things that key errors or misperceptions that we make is that we mistake our thoughts, our filters, our beliefs, our opinions for reality. And you know, this happens all the time. I mean, we can see this in our kind of everyday interactions with people. And maybe we can see it more in how we're thinking that other people are seeing us. So, you know, we might, we feel when other people judge us. That's pretty, you know, we get that feeling, right? You know, somebody gets some idea or view or opinion of us, and they see us through that filter, that view, and put all kinds of projections and ideas onto us. And we feel that, you know, and we kind of rebel against that. It's like, you know, you're not seeing me as I am. You're not seeing the truth of who I am. And turn it around, we do that to others as well. And that's harder to see. You know, it's harder for us to see at times when we are putting our own views, filters, opinions out onto the world, onto our friends, onto our families, onto pretty much everything that we come into contact with. Largely, we experience our world, our experience of the world in our normal state of consciousness is coming through concept and ideas and beliefs rather than through the actual direct experience of what is really happening. So we have this kind of filter, many, 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 many filters that we see things through. And we mistake that for truth. So this is just hearing this can begin to help us to recognize to recognize that, particularly when we see thoughts at play. You know, when we come into meditation, we begin to recognize, oh, there's all kinds of thoughts going on. And when I, we watch the relationship of our experience to what's happening in the world of our thoughts. And boy, do we see a flow. Do we see a wild ride when these thoughts come up. You know, we may have thoughts about this friend from 10 years ago, and, you know, this friend from 10 years ago, oh yeah, you know, that they did this thing, you know, and it was 10 years ago, but there's still a charge about it. You know, this memory arises about this friend from 10 years ago, and the thoughts about what they did and your interaction with them, and then all of these thoughts about what you should say or should have said, or should you get in touch with them, and there's a whole world of emotional reality that's created because of thought. So the we begin to see, as we pay attention in our meditation, we begin to see just how much our reality is influenced by what we're thinking. And, we could have a different time when that friend pops up in our mind, but what we're thinking about is, instead of that thing that they did, the wonderful thing that they did for us. You know, our mind is in a different groove that day, and our mind comes up with the memories about, how helpful that person was at that time when things were so difficult for you, and that they came and helped you out, and then there's all this kind of warmth and love, and it's so that, again, the thoughts in a way create our experience. So we begin to understand through this observing our own minds, and this points to, again, the second part of the Buddha Dharma, which is the practices that he said. So he talked about the truth, and he said, here's a kind of description of reality, impermanent, unreliable, not self. There are filters at play. Clinging, craving are at play in our minds in the creation of this reality of our experience. And he said, and if you want to be happy, you need to look at your experience, understand these truths, not intellectually. He said, we can talk about this forever. We can let the concepts come into our mind, but the concept level is not enough to really penetrate, to help us get past those filters, to help us really. So the concept itself is not generally enough. And then the Buddha said, okay, so there's these, we can describe or talk about things as they are, some of these truths of our experience. And then we have to learn techniques, ways to meet experience so that we can begin to see this truth of how things are for ourselves. And so the second side of the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, is practices, tools to help us see the truth. So the practices of mindfulness and concentration and energy, these are those three aspects of the Eightfold Path: mindfulness, concentration, and energy come together to help us to actually witness, be with our experience, to see, to look at our minds. And so this is what the Buddha was recommending. Look at your mind. Especially, he said, look at where you are suffering. Look at any time or any place you feel like there's something wrong, and understand it. Because he said, inherently, it's not a problem with the way things are, but rather the suffering has to do with our relationship to that. And the filters, the views, the opinions are all our relationship to things as they are. And that, those filters, those views, those opinions, therein is the world of our suffering. Therein is the world of why we are not happy, why we are not satisfied, why we are figuring things are all wrong. So the tools the Buddha taught for helping us to meet that experience, to see for ourselves. And it doesn't actually take that long. I mean, we know, actually. I think I knew that, thinking certain thoughts would make me mad and miserable and unhappy, way before I met the Dharma. We know this, But we don't have the perspective or the understanding to recognize how to look at it. It's kind of like there's inherent in those thoughts. It's kind of like I think the way I used to think about it, you know, thinking back on it, so these thoughts would come up. And, you know, I'd think about that person and what they did, and I'd get all angry, and it'd be like, well, it's a truth. You know, to me, it was like the anger was an unrefutable truth. It was the way things were with that person. There was no way to not be angry with that person. The trick was to not think about that person. You know, so that's what I thought. You know, that there seemed to be such a tight connection there that I could see that thinking about that person, poof, led right to anger. So the trick was, how do I not think about that person? And, you know, I would, you know, jump through hoops trying to not think about that person sometimes. But the Buddha asks us to explore it a little more deeply. You know, yes, you know, it is true that the thoughts are generating the reaction. And yet it's not, again, it's kind of like the way we are with the world, you know, something happens out, like the sound out there. It was at least it was a little far away, but it was kind of an unpleasant, kind of grating sound. And, you know, there could have been a reaction to that. Could have been a sense of, wish they'd stop that. So there's the sound, and then, you know, actually it was far enough away that I could tell it wasn't hurting my ear at all. It was just an opinion about it being an unpleasant sound. And actually when I came more into the moment, it's like it wasn't unpleasant, it was just sound. And so the unpleasantness was more in my idea about it than in the sound itself. So that, you know, we can start to see that with things in the world, that our relationship to them is really where the suffering lies. Well, likewise with our thoughts. Our thoughts, a thought of a person is just a thought arising in the mind. It isn't inherently connected to a whole chain of reactivity. So that thought comes up in the mind and we react to it. We think about it. We kind of jump on it and gather all kinds of evidence and support and whatnot to shore up our opinions, our views, our reactions. But that thought itself is just a thought. It's just like a little blip in the neurons in the mind. It's just a little blip there. And the suffering that's created around it is a reality that our minds are constructing. So this is one of the things the Buddha pointed to. You know, it's like, look into your minds. See where and how suffering is created. Now, I do have to say, sometimes this understanding, I mean, looking at this truth, this capital D Dharma, the truth of things as they are, and essentially the Buddha's teaching that our suffering happens because we're not in alignment with that truth. We're not, our suffering happens because we basically want things to be some other way, whether it's the thoughts in our minds or whether it's the things in the world, you know, the weather, the people we have to work with. We basically would like things to be the way we want them to be rather than coming into alignment with how things actually are. And that's the rub right there. When we're not in alignment with things as they are, suffering is there. Suffering is right there. Now, that understanding of suffering being generated in that not being in alignment with things as they are can often be misunderstood to mean kind of a teaching of non-action. That what we're supposed to do is just sit back and let things be as they are and not try to change anything. Well, there's a little bit of... It's so interesting, what does it mean to not try to change anything? The not trying to change anything is really about what is already here. There's already something here. Actually, it's already a split second ago. By definition, it can't be changed. It's, in fact, vanishing as we're seeing it. That is what we have to accept. The truth of this split second, that is what we have to accept. And in the understanding of that, what seems to be born is not a desire to not act, but rather a desire to move in the direction of alleviating suffering, whether in ourselves or in others. Now, not out of reactivity, not out of hatred, not out of frustration, irritation, not out of desire for something more pleasant, but rather out of compassion for really meeting that truth of suffering. We meet perhaps in the world injustice. So many different forms of injustice in the world. Racism, sexism, homophobia. So many different ways in which people, create their views and opinions and put them out onto others. And, they're ideas. They're not truths. And yet so much suffering happens in this world because of concept and ideas. So there's the truth there of that injustice. There's the recognition that that's what's happening in this moment. Can I come into alignment with recognizing, yes, that is the way it is. And then the next moment, stepping into the next moment, not out of reactivity, but what might be the best thing to do to alleviate that suffering? So it's an interesting kind of dynamic about not trying to change this moment, coming into complete full alignment with, yes, this is the truth as it is. And with that, coming into alignment with that moment, the heart wants to step into the next moment with kindness and compassion, not settling back and saying, whatever, but stepping in with kindness and compassion. And that kindness and compassion can bring an action to it. So the Dharma isn't about non-action. And the teachings of the Buddha, the practices that he suggested are all about action. There's being kind of three flavors of the Buddhist teachings. There's the teaching of ethics that he offers, which is essentially, if what we're interested in is exploring suffering and how to not participate in suffering, how to not create suffering in our own hearts and our own minds, we actually see that non-harming, not creating suffering in the world, is a great way to support not creating suffering in our own hearts and minds. And so that is one of the sections of what the Buddha taught. He taught ethical conduct. And ethical conduct not meaning, some kind of a ruling about what's right and what's wrong, but rather what leads to happiness and what leads to suffering. And that the ethical teachings are in line with what leads to happiness and what leads away from suffering. So, the inclining our hearts and minds to engage with kindness in the world, to not take things that are not offered, to not harm living beings, to not harm with our speech, to not harm with our sexuality. So that's one area of what the Buddha taught in terms of helping us meet the truth. He suggested, you know, if you think about it, if you recognize what happens for you when you behave in ways that hurt others, the mind doesn't come to rest. The mind gets agitated. There's often regret, remorse that's born, and the mind kind of goes back over it. And maybe it feels bad and wants to go back and figure things out, how to patch it up and make things better. But often what goes on in our minds is how to justify what we did. You know, we realize we did something that was harmful. And what our minds do is like, well, but I had to do that, or, you know, that's why it was okay to do that in this situation. And it's amazing just how much agitation is born in our minds when we've created suffering in the world. So the ethical conduct, this non-harming area of the Buddhist teaching, is laying the ground for our minds to settle down so it can meet things as they are. Because as long as our minds are wound up, wrapped into regrets and thoughts and remorse and self-justification and self-righteousness, we're meeting things through our opinions of that, our views of that, and not through the clarity of things as they are. So that's one support for meeting things as they are, to have this sense of ethical or practice of ethical conduct, non-harming. A second area of teaching that the Buddha offered is the teachings around kindness and compassion. You know, softening the heart and mind, opening the heart and mind. And you know, this has two directions to it. One way the heart softens and opens is by actively cultivating thoughts of goodwill, actively cultivating connectivity with others. That begins to soften our hearts and minds, bringing people into mind and actively, you know, wishing them well. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you have, you know, friends, may you have success continue, may you be free from struggle, may you be free from suffering, that, for ourselves as well as for others, that begins to open the heart, open the mind. The other way into this opening and softening of the heart is as we actually meet and connect with suffering in our experience, and as we actually open to the suffering of others. Opening to suffering begins to soften our hearts. When we can open to suffering without rejecting it, without saying it shouldn't be here. This is the other place of that truth, right? So there's this, again, that fine line of suffering is happening in this moment. It's not rejecting that. In fact, it's opening to that truth, that suffering's happening in this moment, either in this mind and body or the recognition that suffering is happening for someone else. That begins to, when we meet that without resistance, the heart more naturally begins to respond with this compassion and with this love. And that's where the action of wanting to alleviate that suffering is born. Not from hatred of the suffering, not from rejecting it or repressing it or hating it, but from opening to it. The love seems to be right there. Our hearts open by meeting things as they are. So this is the second aspect of the teaching, the this aspect of softening the heart, softening the mind. And then the third aspect is really the mindfulness, the teachings around looking at experience moment to moment. And one of the frameworks for this is framed in the first noble truth: understand suffering. When suffering is arising, not to reject it. Again, this is that, you know, suffering's arising right now. It's already here. And one of the beautiful ways to begin to transform that is to understand it. Wisdom begins to transform our relationship to that suffering. And the wisdom also can become an action, can become a motivation for action. Rather than acting out of our greed, out of our aversion, out of our delusion, wisdom arises. It's not us doing it. It's a process. As our hearts open, meet experience, wisdom begins to arise about appropriate response. And that wisdom begins to motivate us. It's not us doing it. It's the wisdom, the compassion, the metta arising begin to create this motivation for action. Well, the whole of the teachings of the Buddha are about acting on our own. I mean, the teaching of the practices are actions that we take to enter into this truth, to begin to see how our minds work. So the Buddha's teaching is not about non-action. You know, it really is, I would say it's a teaching on skillful action, understanding the difference between unskillful action and skillful action. So he's saying that Chinese Taoism has a concept related to actionless action. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Actionless action.
Water is considered to be the paradigm of it. I think it filtered into Zen Buddhism later. Should I just repeat what I said?
Yeah, I don't think it's on. So it's.
It's not.
Now it's on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. In Chinese Taoism, there's a concept called actionless action, of which, well, at least that's how it's translated in English, of which water is considered the paradigm. I think that filtered into
Zen Buddhism
mm-hmm. yeah. a lot. And it's sort of being able to have an effect on the world without, you know, without necessarily disturbing the one's equanimity of
yeah.
things. I think the Chinese word is wu wei. It's a lot in the writings of Alan Watts. Alan Watts isn't always my cup of green tea, but I do like that idea.
Yeah, the notion of actionless action, I think, you know, one way to look at it in terms of what the Buddha taught, in terms of the teachings of the Buddha, is that action in line with the Dharma is motivated not out of a sense of self, of me having to do something. And so the actionless part of it is that there isn't a self doing. The self isn't doing. But there are processes at work. The processes at work, living like water flowing down a mountain. You know, there's just the process of water flowing down a mountain, and it flows around things, and it follows contours, and it will wear things down. It will, it has action. It flows it, and it shifts and alters things. But there's not an agent of water doing that. It's just the process of water doing that. And likewise, our being is a process. And we insert this notion of I am into the picture and get motivated out of that. And that's where I think that's the place to begin to look. Actually, that was one big piece that I spent my retreat looking at, is settling back and watching the mind do what it did and recognizing when the sense of I or me or my came in to try to change things or manipulate things. And, you know, it's like that sense of I, me, mine comes in. It's like, oh, don't like that. Like that, more of that. You know, it's like, it's pretty basic. Pretty, you know, simple little engine in there. Little engine that could. A little engine that says more of this, less of that. But the processes go on. And the more we see into those processes, the more that wisdom and compassion and kindness begin to be the motivators. And it's not a doing of the self. So it's like the water. That's a very good analogy. Yeah. Anybody else have any thoughts they want to share? Or yeah, Lolly, why don't you use the mic too?
I had an experience this past
week. Hold it like this.
I had an experience this past week where something came up and I went into a very familiar place, which was suffering. And I thought about it and I said, this is foolish and so on. But there was something about it that just held me. It was sort of like...
Yeah.
In its grip.
Yep.
And I could think about it and know exactly what to do about it and so on. But there was something, it was sort of like sinking into a, you know, a wonderful hot tub. You know, you're just immersed.
It's familiar.
it's familiar.
Yeah.
And I knew, but there was something about that. It was like, it held me in its grip.
Yes. So there are times in our practice where we see that and we can recognize. And in fact, sometimes our minds can conceptually know, all I have to do is let go of this. You know, our minds can conceptually see how that's created. And yet there's a piece in there of, you know, kind of not filtering into the direct experience, of not actually seeing how the mind is holding. So when that happens, what we do actually is simply recognize the suffering. You know, it's like, and see the gripping. It's like, oh yeah, that gripping is there. And that the process, the way that the practice seems to work is that through the willingness to meet that without judgment, without trying to fix it, so this is where the acceptance comes in, the wisdom begins to grow and deepen. So it's kind of like we meet that experience at a certain level, and as we're more mindful, it's like our understanding or the knowledge or the experience begins to deepen into it, and at some point it begins to see, you know, what's underneath, what's holding it together. But we can't make ourselves see that. And so at that place, what we have to do is open to the truth right now is suffering. And that's, can I open to that? Can I open to that? There's a piece that, let's see if I can... I'll share this from my retreat. And the mind pretty clearly got it that there wasn't something out there that would make it happy. And yet, you know, settling back, my practice was to settle back and not try to stop the mind doing what it was. And I would settle back and I'd watch the mind trying to find something to make it happy. And it's like, okay, you know, I could tell it, I could say, you know, that's not going to work. But it's like the patterns of clinging and holding are so deep. It's like, you know, it's like the processes at work, the depth of our the depth of the clinging to the belief that there is something out there that's going to do it for me. It's so deep. It is so deep. And, you know, what I watched on this one particular sitting, in fact, was like, it's like, kind of like the watch the mind searching, 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 trying to find something, searching, searching, searching. And then it would construct something that was, you know, pretty peaceful, actually. You know, construct a state of concentration, hang out there for a while. It's like, it was way more peaceful than the searching, I have to say. So hang out there for a little while, you know. And then after a while hanging out in that place, it'd be like recognizing the tension that put that state together, you know, the whole holding that was holding that state together. And it's like, oh, that's not it. You know, the mind got it. You know, the mind got it. That's going to be impermanent. It's going to fall apart. And in fact, as it fell apart, as that state fell apart, there was so much ease and joy and happiness. It's like, oh, phew, don't have to hold on to that. And phew, for like a split second, the mind was like, oh, phew, in the flow of just things falling apart and not holding on to anything. And then the mind said, there's got to be something. Got to be something. Let me try again. And it's like the mind at such a very deep level clings. And so patience is really necessary. But I will say that the more we can open to that, how we're holding on, you know, that we are holding on, the more the mind itself begins to understand it. And that's where the freedom comes. We can't use ourself. The self process of saying, oh yes, stop clinging, is not going to free us. It has to happen kind of underneath that self-process. And so it's gonna happen just through the witnessing. And the witnessing reveals the structure of the suffering, and that brings wisdom in the moment that allows things to fall apart. And then you get to watch it do it over again. It's amazing. It is so amazing.
There's something about it, about that place that's so well known.
Yes.
I mean, it really is your identity.
Yes. And so to get familiar with, it's like, wow, this is what that identity feels like. You know, acknowledging it as, the thing that I began to do is really, yep, this is a construction. Okay, this is what this construction feels like. You know, I couldn't stop the construction, but I could recognize it as a construction.
The wonderful thing about it is that I spoke to two of my children about it. And they knew exactly what I was talking about. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Mom. That's where you are.
Sometimes there's wisdom that we can see about others that's harder for us to see about ourselves.
Yes. You're a dip, Mom.
And if you can frame it to yourself that way, oh, it's a dip happening now. Right? I mean, because we take it to be permanent, you know, in some way. So we need to stop. Thank you.